Hello and welcome to episode 528 of Contending at the Water Cooler. I am your host, Clarence Moy, and I am joined by one other M. It's a sausage party. So M, let's tell the listener who you are and where they can find you on the internet.
Hey, man. Sorry, I apologize to anyone. Hi, I'm Joey Moser. You can find me on Twitter at JoeyMoser83.
And again, I'm Clarence Moy. You can find me on Twitter at Clarence Moy. So we are unfortunately without Megan this week. She had some prior commitments. Our scheduling couldn't work out because we were all kind of packing in a lot going on right now. This that time of year, I guess. It's coming up on everybody having lives. And so we are we're just trying to figure it out. So we're flying by the seat of our pants here. So Megan just came back from the SCAD Savannah Film Festival, so she'll be happy to talk all about that next week when we are back together. Hopefully we are back
together. I mean, we have to be transparent. Monday. She's lost in a grocery store somewhere.
She's got pickles flying at her from all
directions. Shit happening. She's getting ripped in half at her local set of legs.
Well, let's hope she's not getting ripped in half. Let's just hope she's getting ripped. I don't know. If you don't follow Megan on Instagram, then you won't know that she loves to hang from ceilings in big circles as if she's trying out for the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Mm-hmm.
She's got incredible core strength, I will say that.
Yeah, I do think it's funny that as much as I talk to her all the time, sometimes I'll look at her Instagram story and I'm like, oh, she's doing that. That makes sense. It's her.
Megan is a woman of many talents.
She's just like, she's like, I'm working at a, I don't know. Like, she's like, I'm on a hot air balloon today. And then like the next day she's like, I don't know, doing something else.
So I'm at an 1880 speakeasy, casually themed by the Gilded Age.
Yeah.
Joey, don't you wish you were here?
I would, yes. Yes, I would.
I would love nothing more, yes.
Yes.
Where Carrie Coon can serve us drinks. Tell us about all the things that are wrong with the world.
I know, right?
Oh, good God. And I would gladly pull up to that bar and drink all night long. Anyway, so we are not talking about any of those things tonight. What we are talking about is related to this fantastic hallway and this carpet that I want in my house. We are talking about not The Shining, but we are talking about something else within the Stephen King universe. It is It. Welcome to Derry. I think that is the official name of the show. So, which has now aired two episodes on HBO Max, and Joey and I are going to break our reactions down and kind of our thoughts about this show, and then of course we'll move to the flash forward to the media we're most anticipating in the upcoming week. So it'll be a quick and dirty one tonight, folks. Nice. Yeah. So, It, Welcome to Derry. So this is a prequel series, still directed by Andy. I'm going to not even attempt his last name, Muschietti, something like along those lines, who also wrote and directed the It films of the past couple of years, one more successful than the other, coming from Warner. So now they are doing a prequel series. And I'll tell you, Joey, my first thought about this series and my first thought about seeing the trailer was that, oh, HBO's getting into the Stranger Things game.
But that's funny that...
Very sorry. Yes.
Go. Well, I just tweeted something. I don't know if you saw it, that I tweeted something because I was watching a particularly violent scene in episode two that I was just like, so this is releasing week to week and Stranger Things drops all of the first part of the final season right around Thanksgiving. And it's just sort of like there's a drag queen from season five of Drag Race where she where she says, bitch, sit the fuck down and shut the fuck up, bitch. And I was like, that's what Welcome to Derry is saying to Stranger Things. That's what
all
it feels
comes
like.
Back to drag queen, to drag race.
Yes,
it
of
all
course.
Comes back to drag race.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I will say though, when I watched television, normally doesn't shock me. But I have been unplugged from the internet for a little bit now. I'm just trying to go on a social media hiatus, get, you know, refresh, reboot, whatever you want to call it. So I didn't know about the pilot. And I got to the end of this pilot, Joey. I was shocked. I was like,
I was shocked by the beginning of the pilot, too.
Well,
what are we watching?
I was a little bit more prepared for the beginning because, you know, so essentially, this show takes place in the early 60s, right around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. And the show begins with a young child, probably 11, 12, something like that. And he is in a movie theater. He leaves the movie theater. He's run out of the movie theater because he didn't pay for tickets. So he's been chased into the street. He is picked up by a family in a station wagon who, over the course of the next several minutes, becomes increasingly bizarre and irrational in their behavior. The mother is pregnant, who then proceeds to give birth to a bat boy, essentially, you know, the old bat boy from the tabloids, National Enquirer.
Bat soon boy. To be revived on Broadway this upcoming Broadway season. Yes.
Who is still attached to her through the umbilical cord. Hey, nice shiny reference. Still attached to her through the umbilical cord. And the bat just flies around the car and eventually presumably massacres the little boy. We don't know that he's dead, but we do know that the pacifier that he's been sucking throughout the first 5 minutes of the episode flew out of the car's window into the river below and then into the sewer where, you know, all bad things happen in the It universe. And so that sparks a series of investigative and exploration as to what happened to this kid. Why did he die? They haven't found his body, so they assume that he's dead. But his friends kind of try to, they start to get together as young kids in this situation normally do, the kind of Stranger Things-y. They got to get together. They got to figure this out. There's a side plot that is becoming increasingly important where a man by the last name of Hanlon. So those of you who know It is a very important last name in this series. Joins this military base. So we haven't really seen kind of by the pilot, you don't really see kind of what's going on there. You get a little bit more information about it in the second episode, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute. So that's sort of where we are within this universe. Joey, what did you think of It, Welcome to Derry?
So I knew it has good reviews, but not like enthusiastic reviews from some things. So I went into it after the first two episodes dropped, not being like skeptical, but I was like, all right, how good is this possibly going to be? And I made a joke with Megan offline that it was like, I think it was because we were talking about how Zach Cregger is developing a Gladys prequel movie. And I was like, I don't want to see that. I don't need to see that. And then I was like, what? Pennywise is like an entity. Like, does he do really badly in clown school and he gets mad and that's why he turns evil? I don't know. So I made that joke. And I feel like these two episodes, I had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of it is like pure nightmare fuel. Mm-hmm. I like how, and maybe you can attest to this too, that like, I remember when I was little, when I saw stuff that actually scared me when I was a little kid. And I imagine there is somebody, some little kid somewhere who secretly turns on Welcome to Derry and is going to have nightmares. And to that I say, good, you should have nightmares. I had a reaction to both episodes, probably a little bit more to the first episode than the second episode, where when crazy stuff is happening, where I'm just like not just like guffawing and laughing, but I'm just like, what the fuck are we watching? And I had that distinctly at the beginning and the end of episode one, there's a dream sequence in episode two where a girl is like clawing at her bed that is really messed up. And then the grocery store scene, I just thought I was when the thing wraps around her neck and goes a little Nightmare on Elm Street, like in her mouth and stuff, I turned and I looked at Jason, who, so for people who don't know Jason, who's a broad, burly man, he
Who's
was just
also
like,
infatuated with Stephen King, right? He
yeah,
loves
love
Stephen
Stephen
King.
King. He's like curled up like this, like on the couch, like in pure horror. So I really dig it. I think that I God, the Stephen King universe is so vast and referential to each other in a sort of non, I would say non-Marvel-y way. Like in the scene where the girl is going through the grocery store and you can see the cans of, I don't even know what they are, but it's like these giant wide cans with a red label that they are in. I know this, I saw that documentary Room 237. The
Oh,
cans
it's
that are in,
the yeah, it's
it
the
has like the Native American on
yeah, the
it.
Native American guy.
So it's like that is in the pantry in The Shining. So there's a lot of like little Easter eggs like that. And when they said Dick Halloran's name in episode two, like my neck snapped and I was like, Dick Halloran,
It's Scatman Carruthers from The
yeah,
Shining.
I actually thought of Groundskeeper Willie. I just like the Shinning. That's what I thought of.
You don't want to get sued.
Don't want to get sued. But I'm having a great time. I think even on just like a practical level, I think the production design is fucking crazy. I love Taylor Page. I love Giovanna Adepo. I was getting a little worried in episode two that it was getting a little too, I don't want to say too plot heavy, but they're still unpacking and establishing stuff, so I just need to shut up.
There's a
But
lot of world building here.
yeah, totally.
And from the first episode, I want to talk about the second episode in a second. Of course, we've only seen two because you and I both, we did not request screeners for this one. We were watching it along with everybody. We're kind of experiencing it week to week, which I've wanted to do, tended to want to do more recently. When I first started watching this pilot, I was a little bit concerned that there was an imbalance in entertainment value between the Giovanna Depo sequences, the military set sequences that felt a little bit cliche to me, and the kids stuff. And I was definitely gravitating toward the kids stuff. Now, a lot of that had to do with the fact that I was mentally prepared for this to be Stranger Things,
Yeah, me too.
in the It universe. If you haven't seen the pilot, fast forward through the next 30 seconds because I am going to spoil the way that it ends. But with the pilot, the kids, they hear a song. So there's a the child that was missing in the beginning speaks to one of his friends through the pipes. And we know who that kid who's speaking through the pipes, but is speaking to a young girl who's gone through Juniper Hill, which is like a local mental institution. She's gone through some troubles because her father was what was it? He was cut up in the pickle making machine, or he was
Yeah, he
jarred
got
and
caught in the machine.
And I don't know why I'm laughing at that, but it's just a terrible way to go, which we do see in evidence of in the second episode. But he sings a song to her, and so they're like, "Where do we hear this song? Where do we hear this song?" Well, the music man. And I is playing Derry. So the little boy that was the movie that he was watching when he was kicked out of the theater. So they one of their friends is the daughter of the projectionist in this movie theater. So she takes them to the theater, she sets up the reel, she spins it, and there's the music man. But in the background of the music man is the little boy who was killed in the beginning, and he's holding this rag, and I'm like, oh no. And of course
Oh
that's
no.
Pennywise in Bat Boy form. He flies through the screen and slaughters all but the two girls, like brutally murders, like
does rips. He rip one in half? Like, well, like
I don't know what he did with the taller kid, the shorter kid with the curly hair, whose family, who had the Holocaust trauma,
yeah,
who had the Ed Gein lampshade. He throws him against the wall, and he's just like raining blood down on the. And then the other kid, I think he does rip him in half, and then there's this incredibly traumatic scene, which, by the way, if you closed your eyes and missed it in the first episode, they're gracious enough to repeat it for you in the beginning of the second episode in even more graphic detail. One of the boys' younger sister is reaching for the survivor girl, and the survivor girl gets up and she's just holding her arm.
Yeah.
This is not Stranger Things at all.
No.
They have abused me of that image. I was shocked. And like I said, TV, I have seen all of Monster, the Ed Gein story. I am not easily shocked by television. I was definitely shocked by this. And fortunately, as we go into the second episode, the two stories start to kind of interact a little bit better. I find that there's a little bit more momentum in the military segment of the story. Mm-hmm. We do meet Dick Halloran, and we start to find out why they're there. There are some things that are revealed. There's an item that is dug up that I don't understand at all, that I have. Then I'm just gonna have to wait till the next episode. You got to figure it out. But you're talking about your grocery store scene. I have to say that was brilliantly directed television because of the way it is filmed, the production design of the grocery store, the way that they manipulate walls to simulate her being trapped, almost like she's trapped in the Overlook maze.
The maze. Yes, exactly.
Yep.
Yes.
It's so easy to, I think, recreate sort of CG based, and I know they tried to do a lot of practical effects, but to recreate, it's not easy, but you know, it's expected of something like this to do grotesque horror situations where people are thrown in the air and ripped apart and all that stuff. But this scene, which was done practically, I believe, with the exception of the final moment, where the walls are moved in and out and she's disoriented, and the sound design is, you know, there's somebody speaking over the loudspeaker, and of course they're saying, you know, repeat the same thing over and over again until they basically call her out and say she's crazy. I thought that was just a brilliantly directed sequence. I just was very dazzled by it.
Yeah, I think it's not the thing I loved about that sequence is it wasn't all about jump scares. It was all about like perception and camera work. And like, I love how, like, when she, like, you know, turns down one eye or she's approaching a new one, like, you see like a guy just kind of go like this.
Oh, yeah.
And like, he's not in focus. And I just thought that it was really brilliant. That whole thing was awesome. And just when I thought, like, when you see like the one wall moving in its place, like, I kept thinking, oh, when she turns around another corner, it's going to do the same thing, but it doesn't do that until like later. So I thought that was really surprising. I was a little worried about the stuff at the military base being like too disconnected from everything, but I can feel it like inching together. And I think that so far, like episode two, when you get to see the, you know, implications of like Taylor Page, when she's out doing errands by herself, like there's that real, like, it's so blatant, but it's under the surface of the time period of racism, of like, I felt like everyone looking at her, and I kept wondering, like, you know, how that might feel as a, you know, a black woman not seeing anyone else looking like her. And then, like, I don't know, it was just, I was very unsettled by so much stuff in here, obviously by design, the horrific elements, but also just the time period and the sort of where we are in our country and the sort of really bright American iconography. Like they're putting together like literally a Paul Bunyan statue at one point. And I have to say, like, I don't like the Music Man. So the Music Man is even more horrific to me now. Like, if I was in a movie theater, I used to work in a movie theater where we would watch movies like after work. And if I was alone and in a theater and I heard, Down in River City, I'd be like, ah, just like, go away. No, not the Music Man.
No,
But no,
not the Music Man.
I'm really enjoying my time so far, and I do feel like, sort of to your point, we are sort of seeing like Stephen King shoving the Duffer Brothers over and being like, phew. And I'm like, yay.
Well, I think they're so inspired by him already
Oh,
that,
yeah.
they're tapping into the same vibes. But here, you're actually tapping into the universe, the actual characters, the actual events. And it feels different to me than Castle Rock did first per se, because Castle Rock kind of, I felt like they were working with the same characters, but it was almost like in an alternate universe. I don't want to say like a multiverse Stephen King, but it wasn't the exact same version of these characters that we know from the novels. And I think this is an extension of something that we would see in a Stephen King novel. Like this is based within the confines of a Stephen King universe. And I think it benefits from that. I will say, just to comment on a couple of things that you mentioned, Taylor Page, great so far in the second
Yeah, she's
episode. We haven't
great.
seen very much of her, but she's just such a warm, welcome presence. I find it very interesting, her interactions in Maine in the 1960s, in the early 1960s, where it's not something that is set in the Deep South. You're not going to get a certain level of interaction, but that there's an undercurrent of it there. So I find that push and pull kind of very interesting. The second thing I want to follow up on from what you said is I use enjoy in quotes. The show is good. It's not a great show yet. I think it could be a great show. I think it could be a very fascinating show. I'm watching this and of course these children are actors. They understand, like, these are not actual things that are happening to them. They understand the trauma that they're going through is all make-believe, but it's so intense. The scenes where the Pennywise entity is terrorizing these children. There's a scene before the grocery store sequence where the daughter of the projectionist has been visited by Pennywise, who is, approximating her dead mother. And there's this sequence where she has to be rebirthed. And then
That's
she
so
crawls out of
great.
this womb and she's connected by this umbilical cord and she's being pulled back in the womb, but the womb is Pennywise's jaws that you've seen from one of the first films, with the two little lights that are like, I think they call them the dead lights, if I remember correctly. That scene, I had to look away a little bit, just a tiny little bit. I had to like just kind of glance to the side. First of all, it was incredibly well done. The special effects, the visual effects, the makeup design, top notch. It was really intense. It was just, just that.
There's like texture to a lot of this, like that you don't get in a lot of stuff, and probably because they are doing a lot of practical effects. Like the whole, like, it's not just when we see her touch, I guess, the membrane, I guess, or the womb
Yeah,
of, and it's
that
all.
scene reminded me of Nope when they were inside
Oh,
that alien in the sky when they were pushing,
yeah.
anyway, continue.
Oh no, it's just like it reminded me of, like, I'm sure they put that little girl in something, and it was just like, I don't know, it feels more textured than something else. Not to like keep bashing another show like Stranger Things. It's just it deals with children and it's kind of sci-fi and it's an established property, but it's kind of like where some people may have complained about, CGI or something like that. This feels very tactile, and which probably makes it scarier. That's what probably makes the sequences a little scary. It's sort of the same thing with the supermarket scene with with the kid. I'm sorry, I keep laughing at the kids being murdered, but you know, the kids being thrown up against a wall in a movie theater. So I don't know.
I did hear that there was some scuttlebutt. There was some conversation around the pickle jar sequence, and potentially that was AI.
Oh no!
I don't know that. I don't know. I mean, if it looks like really good CG to me, but what's the difference between really good CG and AI? I guess somebody's making it. If it's CG versus AI, it's just a computer making it. I don't know. One thing that I don't know. Go back and watch it and see. Tell me what you think. I don't know if I saw any, like,
you know, you can kind of tell when something is AI if you like look at it long enough.
Not a Coke commercial though. The last thing that I'll say that I love about the show, and there's a lot to explore here, and you know, as it progresses, and I'm very interested to see, like, I don't expect that all of a sudden they're going to casually refer to Annie Wilkes because that's in, you know, Colorado, I guess. But I'm very anxious to see kind of how it progresses, how it evolves, what, you know, they are introducing cliffhangers at each chapter, because Stephen King was very influenced by sort of chapter plays, chapter films, you know, these cliffhanger adventures that he saw at movie theaters and in reading in his childhood. So they're introducing a cliffhanger at the end of every episode, and I'm very interested to see where it goes. I will say this is absolutely a front runner for the Emmys at main title design. Those are,
oh God,
stunning.
That's a long sequence.
It's a long sequence. They're visually stunning. They are thematic. They tell you exactly what you need to know about the show. They tell you the horror. Like it touches upon the horror of the, you know, the pending horror of the Bay of Pigs, and the, you know, the potential of the Cold War, and the potential nuclear war that was, you know, a big threat at that point. So it just gorgeous, gorgeous production design and gorgeous main titles. Those are my two favorite things about the show.
Yeah, it was the main title design. I saw you tweet about it, and then I saw the tweet before I started watching it, and I was like, oh, it's one of those things where they don't put the main title in front of the first episode, they put on later episodes, and I was so excited to see the main title design. And it's like, I hate that it feels nostalgic, because, and that's what they're obviously going for, but it's sort of like they're taking everything you hold dear, this Americana that I mentioned before, and they're really just vomiting blood all over it.
Yep.
And making it really socially conscious, and it's really disturbing. So
it's what they intend.
Good. Good.
So
kill them kids.
It airs on Sunday nights on HBO Max at 9 p.m. Eastern. So we have one coming up this weekend. We're straight up through to Christmas.
Most wonderful time of year. You thought Halloween was over? Tune to HBO Max.
Exactly. Blah, blah, blah.
So what's I mean, by the time that we record next time, we'll have seen episode 3 and Megan will have caught up. So we'll have to hear what she thinks.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I know they did a screening for it at the SCAD Savannah Film Festival, and where they had a lot of the cast and director. So I'm interested in hearing that experience. So we'll talk about this a little bit next week. So let's jump to the flash forward. Joey, what are you looking forward to this weekend?
Something I think we're also going to talk about next week is Rachel Sennett's I Love LA, which I saw the first episode and I quite enjoyed. I think I liked it more than I expected, even though I adore Rachel Sennett. I still think she needs to play Natalie Portman's sister in something, and no one will listen to me. There we are. I am trying my damnedest to get through a lot of docs we're voting in the Critics' Choice Documentary Awards. I feel like now it's like, remember, it's November. So I want to catch up on movies. I think the movie I'm most excited to see is Die My Love. Which comes out on Friday here. I'm going to get home from work on Friday. I'm going to pick up my dog, drop it off, and immediately go to the theater to go see Jennifer Lawrence in that movie. But I also want to see, like, we were, since we're both part of Critics' Choice, we're starting to, we have the fortune of, getting screeners for stuff in anticipation of those awards. So I think another one that I haven't watched yet that I'm oddly very excited about is Nuremberg, which actually comes out in theaters this weekend too. So yeah, lots of movies, and I will be stressing out. And then I'm also reading a book called it's gay, shocking. 7 Days in Tokyo by Jose Daniel Alvior, which is lovely and sweet. It's a nice counter programming to Stephen King. So that's
Absolutely.
busy, busy.
I too am looking forward to the next episode of I Love LA. We'll talk about this in more depth because I know this is a big thing that Megan wanted to discuss. But I will say that was very much a pilot, and I'm interested to see kind of how the characters evolve. I wasn't necessarily as taken with it as you were. I'm not saying it's a bad show, but it didn't. The what I took away from that, and I do like Rachel Sennett, what I took away from that was Odessa Dazion. I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly, forgive me. She's a star. She walks all over that entire cast. And with
Oh, like charisma,
oh my God, I
which
mean, I know people have talked to, she's also in Marty Supreme. Big year for her. I am so locked into seeing what this woman does. Because she is fantastic in this show.
yeah, she's great. That I also thought about how I really want to see Marty Supreme now after seeing her in that, but also it made me think, it's like, God, I never want to live in LA. Holy
Yeah.
crap. Just those 30 minutes was like, good God, no.
It's fun to visit, but living, I don't know. So for me, catching up on some films that we've received via screener. Also, one of my, I'm not going to say it's one of the best films of the year, but one of my personal most favorite films of the year, one of that I had the most fun in, was Fantastic Four: The First Steps.
Oh,
Just
yeah.
stupid fun from beginning to end. I think for the first 30 minutes, I sat there and I was blown away by the production design, this retrofuturistic take. And I just had this giant smile on my face. It arrives on Disney Plus tomorrow as we are recording, November the 5th. So it did well. The box office made almost $300 million, but it still, for some reason, has the stink of failure on it. I don't know why. Maybe the expectations for Marvel movies have gone so high. For those of you who have given up on Marvel movies, this is a really good one, I would argue. I think you had a good time on it,
Oh,
right? And you're not a
I
Marvel
love
person.
it. I'm
Yeah.
so Marvel allergic, it's not even funny, but this is just like, it made me think of like, you can do something like this, and it
Yeah,
can be, it doesn't have to be
100%.
like a byproduct of the 32 other movies before it. Like, have fun, have more. I want them to have more fun.
It's fun. It's got great characters. It's got, great acting for a Marvel movie. And the production design and the score by Michael Giacchino are fantastic. So check it out if you haven't seen it, if you have Disney Plus, unless you've become so pissed at Disney that you have now gotten rid of Disney Plus. But anyway, there's also available on Blu-ray, on TV. For some reason, I am, aside from I Love LA and It, Welcome to Derry, I have been watching Murder House, American Horror Story Murder House. I've been revisiting Murder
Ah,
House before the
yes.
announcement. I will say before the announcement. And by the way, I must say to all the people who think that Jessica Lange is coming back full force into the Ryan Murphy universe, remember that she was only in Apocalypse for like a single half of an episode.
Yeah.
She's not coming back for anything more than that. She's going to still play Constance. She's not playing, I don't think she's going to play the Supreme again from Coven.
Naughty Pines,
Yes. Not a bad.
Naughty Pines.
But I'm revisiting American Horror Story Murder House, and it's so damn dark. It is such a
Really? Ugh.
just an unrelenting piece of darkness. And I remember how it ends, so I'm getting there, but I'm enjoying the rewatch, and I don't know that I'll rewatch Asylum. I may get back to rewatching Coven though, because I remember really loving
Yeah.
Coven.
I love the first half of Coven. It's so campy and bitchy and fun, and then they took like,
Bitchcraft.
yeah, it they took like their hiatus, and it was like the first time like around the holidays, and I remember that it really felt as if Ryan Murphy had a emergency meeting. He was like, can we get Stevie Nicks? Can we get Steve? It was like, stop developing the show as you go. Now, I don't know if that's what they
The
did, but
Seven Wonders.
that's what it felt like. But I've actually been wanting to, oh God, I've been wanting to revisit one of those seasons, and I didn't know where to start.
Got to
So,
start with the
and
beginning, the best. Nothing
I
beats Murder House, I think, because you're right. Like, Naughty Pine.
Nutty Pie!
We've been, I mean, as long as we've been talking about, as we've been having this podcast, we've been talking about Ryan Murphy shows. And every season of American Horror Story post Murder House starts strong. And then right around five or six just shits the bed.
Yeah,
But
they
I think
do.
he really had Murder House plotted out from beginning to end in a way that he didn't necessarily for the subsequent season. So I would recommend revisiting Murder House. There's a lot of things I forgot about it. There were nice little surprises. Like I forgot the whole the character that oh God, I'm forgetting her name.
Frances Conroy.
Frances O'Connor plays. She has two different versions of her character.
Oh,
Do you
yeah.
remember
Yes,
that?
now as soon as I remember being that when you find out what happened to her, it was actually like really sad.
Well, see,
And
that's the thing
like,
that I'm talking about. The undercurrent of all of these stories is this incredible sadness, this deep well of sadness.
Well,
Because
I assume that he showed all of his regulars the first couple episodes of All's Fair, and they're like, well, we have to come back. We have to, this it was basically a creative intervention.
we have to watch All's Fair. We have to see what
Oh, I've started it.
is it that bad? Is it really that bad?
It's like so, and I start the only way that I can think I can describe it is the way that they drop you down into it, and it feels like, I mean, shows do that all the time, but it does it like the there's a I saw someone say there's a confrontation between Sarah Paulson and Glenn Close in a bathroom. And Sarah Paulson, these are women who are like lawyers. And I understand that, you know, camp and like recalling maybe something else like from the great yesteryear of camp, bitchy, glamorous women. I totally get that. But like there's at one point where Glenn Close, like Sarah Paulson, she's like at all of them, really. And then she Glenn Close, very just calm without even batting an eye, she like turns to Sarah Paulson and she's like, I bet your mother wishes that she would have swallowed instead. And she just
Oh,
like turns
God, come
back
on.
around and looks in the mirror. I don't know. It's I saw someone describe it as a Twitter feud reply dialogue, which I
Oh.
thought was funny. Maybe it gets better, but I saw it has 0% on Rotten Tomatoes, and someone in the UK referred to it as the worst drama ever made. And I was like, well, that's hyperbolic.
That's what makes me want
So
to see it because,
it
like,
does a lot, and I w
yeah. And what lives in it that elicits that level of hatred? That's the thing that makes me want to see it. So, I'm also reading. I just started Hamnet.
yeah, I will say it took me a while to like get into it a little bit, but yeah.
Sorry, we have a little bit of a delay. I also started reading Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell after seeing the film at Telluride. So I'm ready to sob my way to work every day.
I bought that book in Telluride on the last day, and it's just staring at me from my bookshelf. I need to finish this book and then get on it because I know a couple people that have started reading it and they say it's great. And I was like, well, if you think the book is great, the adaptation's great too. So, ta-da.
Excellent. So does that cover it?
Yeah.
All right, let's get the hell out of here. So we are the two M's, contending co-founders Joey Moser and Clarence Moy, missing Megan McLaughlin. Thanking you for joining us, asking you to remember to rate us on your favorite podcast app or provider, or click like and subscribe here on YouTube, and wishing you a very pleasant tomorrow.